The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. President Trump's magnificent Independence Day speech at Mount Rushmore was maligned by elite media.
President Trump never mentioned any dead Confederates. His speech in its bulk was a ringing, a full-throated defense of America's history and heroes.
Word has it that Houston is now the epicenter for COVID-19, displacing New York. Is that what it looks like on the ground?
I think the idea behind it is to create a narrative that, in fact, our more freedom-based approach was faulty, and now we're getting our comeuppance.
Primaries in New Jersey last week were all mail-in. Can we trust the results?
The idea that voting has to be something super easy that you can do without any effort, I mean, maybe the effort leads us to a better process.
And Joe Biden appears to have confused his tests.
I've been tested and I'm constantly tested.
Look,
all I got to do is watch me, and I can hardly wait to compare my cognitive capability to the cognitive capability of the man I'm running against.
I'm Bob France, sitting in for Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. You can catch my program 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern daily on AM 1420 The Answer in Cleveland and on demand worldwide at WHKRadio.com. Let me invite you to follow me on Twitter at France Radio, F-R-A-N-T-Z Radio, and follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We'll begin with the 4th of July. Except for neighborhood parties and amateur fireworks, most of the nation went eerily quiet on this year's celebration of our nation's independence. Except in South Dakota, where the night before, our president gave a speech, one of his best, at the foot of magnificent Mount Rushmore. His speech was not Trump-centric. He did not boast. He stayed on script. And he took a clear-eyed view of our nation's unique history and our hard-fought standing in the world. The next morning, however, our nation's largest and most influential news outlets panned the speech. That was no surprise, but their critique this time ascribed to the speech substance and tone that just wasn't there. My colleague Hugh Hewitt explored this media hatchet job with Michael Scheer, White House correspondent for the New York Times.
This is the Wall Street Journal. The editorial begins, President Trump delivered one of the best speeches of his presidency Friday evening at Mount Rushmore. I said what the Journal said on Al Sharpton's show on Sunday. I thought it was one of the best five speeches he's given, along with Saudi Arabia, Poland. And at the conclusion of 2 days of commentary on Mount Rushmore, Britt Hume said this to Brett Baer on Monday.
Well, the first thing is, Brett, President Trump never mentioned any dead Confederates. His speech in its bulk was a ringing, a full-throated defense of America's history and heroes, and there were no Confederates mentioned. It was all the fathers, you know, the forefathers of our country,
Washington,
Lincoln, and other great Americans. This was a speech meant to be inspiring. If you think the messenger was flawed, the speech itself was quite strong and in some ways very positive.
What do you make of this as a reporter I esteem, and I think my audience esteems, of what is a complete collapse in the reporting aspect of the Mount Rushmore speech?
So, look, I mean, I think that my thoughts are, I think I have two thoughts on this. One is that context matters when you deliver a speech. And I think that you would probably agree that the words that a president or, frankly, anybody speaks in a speech, you know, can be interpreted differently depending on the context in which that speech is given. The things, the events that are happening around that time. And so the fact that he, for example, that the president, for example, didn't address what is one of the sort of, you know, predominant things happening at the moment, which is this racial unrest and demands for social justice is notable in and of itself, and so that it strikes a different tone. And then the second thing I would say is that it underscores just the completely polarized nation that we live in, that people see things through their own lenses. You know, liberal America hears that speech and hears one thing. Conservative America hears that speech and hears a completely different thing. And I think the challenge for journalism, getting back finally to your question, and, you know, I do think that it is incumbent upon journalists to report, to report not through a particular set of lenses, left or right, but to report on what the president said and to give it some context without lurching into opinion.
You know, Michael, I understand that, and I don't want to put you in a position of criticizing either your colleagues at the paper or at any other paper. But I do believe there is something of note, and I think historians will read the speech and they will see a seminal moment when the president declares that the radical view of American history is a web of lies. That is a seminal moment. I think it will become known as the web of lies speech. And I believe it will be, if there is a turning point for the Trump campaign, if he rebounds from being behind, it will be because of that speech aimed at the center of America, the pride of America. It does not address racial tensions directly. It addresses violence in the streets. But when it comes to the media, I don't think context is what the people expect from news reporters. I think they expect, what did he say and to whom did he say it?
I don't disagree with you that there are problems in the media. We struggle every day. We make mistakes every day. And I think that there are, you know, some examples of the media getting caught up in what I would consider not traditional news reporting and opinion and sort of lurching into opinion. I agree with that.
As America slowly comes out of its COVID lockdown, several states that were on the front lines are experiencing a spike in their numbers on the virus. This surge was widely predicted by the medical community. They had expected that once the country softened its controls over citizen behavior, we would all notice an uptick in infections. Texas was early in opening up, and it experienced a large spike. Media was quick with the I told you so's directed at Governor Abbott. They spoke of Houston as the new ground zero of COVID victims. We'll turn to someone who's right there. Bo Breeze, an emergency room physician at Houston Methodist Hospital. He joined Dennis Prager.
Tell us what the reality on the ground is.
It's busy. There are a lot of patients that are arriving with symptoms of COVID. We're in a second peak, which was expected. We were talking about there being a second peak all the way in January. But it is busy like other periods in which we've been busy during flu seasons in prior years. The number of deaths per day that we're having in Houston has been roughly the same since April. So while we're seeing a lot of cases, the number of deaths per day has been pretty steady. So it requires us to change some of our processes to adapt and expand capacity, but in ways that we anticipated, in ways that we planned for, in ways that we're enacting.
So when you read these reports, which are now almost universal in the media, of Houston as the new epicenter, and therefore this means another lockdown, how do you react?
It seems to me that they're pushing a narrative that isn't based on reality. They're pushing a story that lends to a certain narrative about freedom versus a more controlled response, like you saw in Seattle and New York. Seattle and New York, many of the places that enacted more severe restrictions had much higher mortality rates than we did in Texas, where we had sort of a more freedom-based approach to voluntary self-isolation until it became mandatory, masking, all the rest of that. And so I think the idea behind it is to create a narrative that, in fact, our more freedom-based approach was faulty, and now we're getting our comeuppance. But I don't think that the reality on the ground matches that. I think we can handle what we've got. I think we can handle where it's going. And it's a lot of work, but it's work that we're prepared for. This is why we have emergency medical systems. This is why we all train to do what we do.
Are we a lot better at treating COVID patients today than, let's say, in April?
Yes. There's a lot less mystery about the disease. Of course, in 2 years, a layman will know more than any expert does today on the disease. We know strategies that work. We know how much uncertainty we have about which drugs may or may not work. And we know how to recognize it much more easily. So I think it's much easier to treat now than it was in April. I mean, I've taken care of over 100 patients. I've lost track. And it is much easier to take care of them today than it was a few months ago.
How long are they in for on average?
Well, it's an interesting question, right? So when they come into the emergency department, they arrive and we discharge most of them. Because most people are feeling sick and they're wondering what's wrong. Sometimes they're feeling quite uncomfortable, but they're actually quite stable. So the vast majority of patients go home the same day.
With COVID or without COVID?
With COVID. The vast majority of patients with COVID go home from the emergency department safely, with medications in place to make them feel comfortable while they get over a disease that is like an extended cold for most of them. It makes them feel uncomfortable in ways they haven't felt uncomfortable before, but not one that's going to risk their life.
With the 2020 election season upon us, a hot topic of division between parties is the reliability of mail-in voting. One test has already occurred, New Jersey, which held its primaries this past week. My Salem colleague, Kevin McCullough, from AM 970 The Answer in New York, turned to Carol Markowitz of the New York Post.
Let's shift to Election Day. It's a primary day in New Jersey, but there are new reports, and New Jersey is voting primarily by mail-in ballots, although there were a handful of precincts open throughout the day. But there's a big report out that argues that they're the perils of this, and it comes from the Honest Elections Project is the group that did this report, that there are all sorts of problems with write-in ballots. Your thoughts on if we were forced to do this in the fall, would you have confidence that the election would have integrity to it?
I absolutely would not. The issues with mail-in voting are so vast and so obvious. And I think that just people pretending otherwise is absurd. You can have an activist go door to door and fill in everybody's name, on their block. You can have the most motivated person in somebody's family vote for everybody in their family. This is not the democratic process, and anybody pretending otherwise is just kidding themselves.
Well, but see, if you say that on Twitter, Carol, you know they come for you, right? You know, just this year you had 800 ballots in Paterson, New Jersey that were found bundled together. I don't think that's how it works. I don't think you go collect them all up and send them in. I think that only happens if you're doing something right. Nefarious with them.
The idea that voting has to be something super easy that you can do without any effort. I mean, maybe the effort leads us to a better process. Maybe the fact that you have to try a little bit to get your voice heard is a good thing. And especially in primaries, why would any party want to just have, you know, people who don't care about the process voting in their primary process?
Coming up, Joe Biden's been tested.
I've been tested and I'm constantly tested. Look, all I got to do is watch me, and I can hardly wait to compare my cognitive capability to the cognitive capability of the man I'm running against.
The case of a candidate's mistaken test count, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Bob France from AM 1420 The Answer in Cleveland, sitting in for Hugh. If we were living in more normal times, this country's political halls would have been jumping feverishly by now as we approach what is an election season for the ages. But we're not living in normal times. And yet there will be noise soon enough, pandemic or not, as the countdown to November 3rd begins in earnest. My colleague, Sebastian Gorka, discussed what is approaching with Matt Boyle of Breitbart.com.
Let's talk about current events happening here in D.C. You've been writing about the Supreme Court. What happened this week in the Supreme Court, Matt?
Well, there were a number of cases that came down. Several of them were very bad decisions, I think. So they upheld DACA. They overturned the Louisiana abortion law. It's proof that, as with any other election, this upcoming one, the Supreme Court, is going to be a major determining factor. And so if you want the Supreme Court to become social justice warriors, you want those justices to be like the people out there tearing down statues, then vote for Joe Biden or the Democrats. If you want law and order, if you want sense and normalcy and common sense and so on and so forth, then vote for Trump and the Republicans. And I think that it's this is a real serious thing. This is not a joke. This is not a game. There could be as many as 4 vacancies in the next presidency, maybe more. You've got Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 87 years old. Obviously, she's in and out of the hospital with a number of different procedures, ailments, etc. You have Stephen Breyer, who's 81 now. He'll be 82 by the election. And then you also have rumors this week that Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, and I've heard rumors like this for a while, are considering retirement. Then not this year, but maybe if Trump is reelected. But those guys are both getting up there too. It is very possible that there could be as many as 4, maybe more, vacancies in the next term. And again, that could drastically change the direction of our country. Do we want to go in this crazy radical leftist Marxist direction?
Given the recent events in Minneapolis, across the nation, how much do you think, when people go into that booth November 3rd, it's going to be not coronavirus, not China, it's going to be law and order that is determinative?
I think that all of those things combined are going to be things that people talk about. So I think that it's going to be a combination of, do I have a job and do I need one, and what, who's the better jobs candidate? And obviously that candidate is Donald Trump. Joe Biden never worked a real day in his life. With that, the economy, China is also very important. Who's going to hold China accountable? The obviously the pandemic is going to be a big issue, and then law and order. I think all of those things combined, and then other things like the long-term sustainability of the country, like the Supreme Court, I think that's important.
Joe Biden responds to a question about his cognitive capacity.
Last question, real quick. Some have speculated,
that you
are subject to some degree of cognitive decline. I'm 65. I don't have word recollection that I used to have. I forget my train of thought from time to time. You got 12 years on me, sir. Have you been tested for some degree of cognitive decline?
I've been tested and I'm constantly tested. Look, all I got to do is watch me, and I can hardly wait to compare my cognitive capability to the cognitive capability of the man I'm running against.
There's 2 theories out there. Number one is he heard what the question was and he responded honestly. And he said, I'm regularly tested for my cognitive reasoning capabilities. Oh, the second theory, and I want you to tell me which one you buy, is that he didn't understand, or he had cognitive issues, and he thought he was being asked about COVID testing, and he said, yes, I'm regularly tested. But either way, there's a problem with the Democrat putative candidate.
Right. Well, so he did answer earlier in the press conference and said that he has not been tested
COVID. He did.
So it's not the COVID thing. So he might have just thought that, you know, being out there and doing speeches, or what he would call a speech, because it's not really a speech where he reads from the teleprompter or off a sheet of paper haphazardly at best, it counts as a cognitive test. But the point is that there actually is a test. It's called the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. This is a test that President Trump has taken.
Yeah,
it's a 30-point test, right? Like, so you can get up to 30 points. If you score higher than 26 or higher, you're considered to have passed. President Trump got a 30 out of 30. Joe Biden, we're not sure if he's taken this particular test or not, which is, again, the test that would be given to a presidential candidate, or if he was just speaking colloquially or not. But the point is that if he has not taken this test, that means that Joe Biden, the literal words of what he said during that press conference, says that he has taken this test. We don't know if he actually has or not. We don't know if he is lying and claiming that he has, but he clearly has a problem.
Recently, Salem Media Group partnered with Larry Elder in the release of a new documentary, Uncle Tom, on our exclusive movie channel. One of the 20 American black conservatives featured in the documentary was former Congressman and U.S. Army officer Alan West. You can learn more about the film at UncleTom.com. Congressman West was a recent guest on the Bob France Authority, my daily program in Cleveland.
give us an update on your health. That motorcycle crash back in May was pretty horrific. I've seen you in some videos with your bandages and your bruises and your as you heal through this process. How you doing?
Well, yeah, I'm doing very well. I would say I'm probably 80 to 85%. It was a horrific crash, and I'm a walking miracle. Everyone knows that no one survives a motorcycle accident at 75 miles per hour on an interstate highway. So it's by God's grace that I'm here. You know, I am back running. I've got back up to doing, 4.5 miles. You know, I don't have time to sit around and expect pity. I'm not a victim. And I just thank God that I can still be in the fight for the country. But it was a horrific accident. The motorcycle is going to be restored and customized, but it's going to be auctioned off for a military charity for a faith-based organization. So my riding days, 35 years of motorcycle riding, has come to an end because I don't want to put my family or friends through that again.
And before I talk to you about the black, or let you talk to us, really, about the black experience in America, particularly for a black conservative, and you are, of course, featured in the wonderful movie by our mutual friend Larry Elder and Uncle Tom. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about your political run and why it ended as soon as it did. Everything I've heard you speak on, from matters relating to the federal government, whether they be foreign or domestic issues or economic issues, I have just nodded my head in agreement and said, yup. I love what you stand for, and I know there are millions of people who do too. But you went a different path after your run in Congress, and I'm curious as to why.
The thing is that sometimes, you just have to be still and be quiet and wait for God to direct your path, as it says in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 through 6, to let everyone see that, I am a miracle, and it has elevated my platform even more so.
Let's talk about your experiences as a black conservative. Let's talk about Uncle Tom. In the movie, each of you talk about what you experience on a regular basis as a conservative. And at what point, by the way, you realized that you needed to be an outspoken conservative African-American?
Well, without a doubt, when you look at the policies of the progressive socialist left, the Democrat Party, how it has absolutely decimated the black community. And that's the great thing about Uncle Tom. It tells the truth. When you look at the failure of the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson, when you look at the 21st century economic plantation, the decimation of the family, the fact that since Roe v. Wade, you've had 20 million unborn black babies murdered in the womb. Look at all of the murders that have happened in these major urban population centers controlled by Democrats for the last 6 to 7 decades, just in the last month. But yet they're not addressing that. They don't want to talk about it.
Coming up, is the U.S. economy in a rebound mode?
Look, this isn't ideal, but I think it's good to keep in mind. We don't need to get back to where we were in February, and that's exactly what we are seeing.
Andy Puzder, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. We saw this week how valuable and how strategic the efforts of ADF are as they contend for our first freedom in the courts. They really are the best and the brightest, contending for the values we share. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Bob France, in this week for Hugh. The Trump economy, which had been building since November 2016, was stopped abruptly in March. We stopped it deliberately to save ourselves and our healthcare system from the mysterious coronavirus, our unwelcome guest from China. Many believed this abrupt stop would usher in a long recession, perhaps something worse than the 2008 Great Recession. Andy Puzder, former CEO of CKE Restaurants, is now a senior fellow at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy, and he's optimistic about a strong recovery. He was a guest of Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago.
So what about my confusion? How do you have a recovery of any shape if you have whack-a-mole, if you use lockdowns to play whack-a-mole with the virus?
Well, the economy does seem to be recovering despite the fact that we have these instances of flare-ups across the country. I'm not saying that it's the best system for either dealing with the economy or the disease, but even the numbers we've gotten for July so far have been very, very positive. People are getting out. They are working. I think when the $600 a week bonus for not working expires at the end of this month, I think you'll see a further surge in people rejoining the labor force. You'll see the unemployment rate come down even more. Look, this isn't ideal, but I think it's good to keep in mind, we don't need to get back to where we were in February immediately. We need to see the economy steadily improving. We need to see people getting back to work. And that's exactly what we are seeing. We're seeing this economy move in the right direction. And while the virus is spreading, I think one thing that we should note very prominently is that deaths are declining. Yeah. Now, one death is too many. We didn't shut the economy down because people were going to get sick. We shut it down because people were going to die in massive numbers, and we're not seeing those numbers.
What's going to happen if they extend the CARES Act and people get that $600 weekly bonus?
I would be shocked if that were extended. I don't think that's going to be extended. I think if the people who would like to see that extended are the people who are trying to impose lockdowns in blue states and blue cities. The people who don't want the economy to recover, they want people to be home and unemployed, at least until the election, because the Democrats view this, one, as their wedge to beat Donald Trump in the upcoming election, and two, once they've done that, it's their wedge to what Joe Biden has very openly called Transform America. I'll tell you what, if you liked the recent shutdown, if you liked the results of the recent shutdown, you're going to love the results of the Green New Deal shutdown, because it's going to make the last few months look like prosperity. So this is their key to transforming the country, and they will fight any effort to try and improve the economy because it's not in their political interest.
President Trump has signaled an openness to another round of disaster relief. You call it, you know, I call it disaster relief. Somebody else calls it stimulus checks for Americans. Put more money directly in America's, in the hands of Americans. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, I'm not a Keynesian. I don't think that putting money in people's pockets drives economic growth. I do think we needed to put money in people's pockets when we locked them out of their jobs, when we made it impossible for people to pay their rent or to buy food or to support their families. I think what we did was good. But doing it going forward, this idea that it's going to create demand, this is like when Obama said, you know, this $800 billion stimulus that they passed in 2009, shortly after he was elected, he promised that unemployment wouldn't go over 8% if we passed this $800 billion in stimulus. Well, it went over 8% the month that it was passed, and it stayed above 8% for 43 consecutive months. Then they promised that the stimulus was going to create 3.8% GDP growth in 2011. And 4% plus in 2012 through 14. Well, as you know, GDP, our economic growth never hit even 3%. We are driving the economy now. We're seeing it improve. We will continue to see it improve as long as government doesn't get in the way.
Don't you find it rather remarkable, the conversations we're having, where you have some people essentially taking the position, you know, we can recover, we can have our economy recover without having an economy. We don't need productivity in the private sector. We have to bail out governments, of course. But the one thing we don't need to do is ever get people back to work and entrepreneurs taking productive risks and all the other things that are the component parts of why we have the greatest economy, the most wealth the world has ever seen.
Well, not only is it ridiculous and hypocritical, but it ignores the human suffering this is creating. There was a study out recently by two medical foundations that said we are suffering an epidemic at this time within the pandemic. It's an epidemic of suicides, drug addiction, and alcohol addiction, which this study said could result in 150,000 deaths independent of the pandemic.
You can catch the entire conversation of Dan and Amy with Andy Poster at townhallreview.com. Coming up,
their religion is in real trouble. It's actually completely hollow and rotten, and I think it is entering its final period.
Trouble in the Church of Environmentalism, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Bob France. Michael Schellenberger was a highly regarded environmental activist. He was co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute. He later founded a group called Environmental Progress. He was all about the effort to save ourselves from imminent environmental devastation. But in the last 3 years, Michael has been rethinking his dogma. He's even apologized about the harmful results of environmental alarmism. He has authored a book, Apocalypse Never, Why Environment Alarmism Hurts Us All. Michael Schellenberger was a recent guest of Dennis Prager.
Tell us what happened to your article where you wrote this mea culpa, this apology on behalf of the environmentalist movement. It was up at Forbes, for which you are a columnist, correct?
Yes, and they took it down against my objections. I felt that the article did not violate any policies, and I've also very much enjoyed writing for Forbes, and they have actually allowed me to publish the truth and the facts for many years now, and I'm going to continue to do that. And so we've come to an agreement that my first person articles will be somewhere else.
How have your colleagues in the environmentalist movement reacted to you?
Well, there's there's a lot of diversity of views. I mean, one of the things that's been happening is that people in the environmental movement have been changing their minds about things like nuclear energy, and I've helped with that a bit over the last few years in making the case for nuclear. And I tend to find that people that are pro-nuclear are less apocalyptic in general. And I think it has something to do with the fact that they understand that nuclear is effectively infinite energy, and with infinite energy, you have infinite freshwater, fertilizer, and food, and therefore there's never ever going to be resource scarcity as long as we have nuclear energy. So all of the apocalyptic claims that some of the climate campaigners make about, you know, running out of food, I think there's some intuitive sense, I don't want to suggest that it's overly conscious, but some intuitive sense that that's not quite right, that our capacity for technical ingenuity is very high. And there's others that are obviously the people that I'm criticizing in the book who are very defensive. I think the interesting thing now, Dennis, because it's only been out for a couple of days, I don't think very many people have really read it yet. They haven't read the book. They read the article I wrote, but I think that when they read the book, I think they're going to discover that their paradigm, their religion, is what I argue is what it is in real trouble. It's actually completely hollow and rotten. And Apocalypse Never, I think, gives kind of a final push to that Berlin Wall of apocalyptic environmentalism, so to speak. And I think it is entering its final period. I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but I don't know if it'll be in a month, but I don't think it'll take 2 years for basically the core elements of what we consider to be environmentalism to be completely discredited.
Rare good news in the year 2020. I want to read from your article. Here are some facts few people know. Humans are not causing a sixth mass extinction. The Amazon is not the lungs of the world. Climate change is not making natural disasters worse. Fires have declined 25% around the world since 2003. The amount of land we use for meat, humankind's biggest use of land, has declined by an area nearly as large as Alaska. The buildup of wood fuel and more houses near forests, not climate change, explain why there are more and more dangerous fires in Australia and California. Carbon emissions are declining in most rich nations and have been declining in Britain, Germany, and France since the mid-1970s. This one I love. Netherlands became rich, not poor, while adapting to life below sea level. I never thought of that. That's pretty powerful. That's as powerful as Bill Gates, another alarmist, who just bought a $43 million home on the coast. I always wonder why people who predict imminent drowning of places on coasts are buying expensive properties on the coast. Is that a legitimate question?
It is for me. Yes, of course. It's obviously an illegitimate question.
People like you, Bjorn Lomborg, I mean, who have such credentials, have been saying these things. And the dismissal of people, deniers, is always the denialist, climate deniers. Prager University, where you have some courses coming out, is, of course, a climate denialist. I'm curious, on a personal note, because that always interests me, did you simply awaken one day and say, I just can't participate in this, essentially, what is a lie?
Oh, heavens no. It was a very, it's been a very long process. I mean, I think this is, you know, I mean, really, for some ways, Apocalypse Never is the bookend to an essay I wrote 15 years ago called Death of Environmentalism. And at the time, it was motivated out of a sense in which I was reading a lot of civil rights histories. I was reading this beautiful history of the civil rights movement called Parting the Waters by Taylor Branch. I'm sure you know it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about love in the face of hatred. It's a very profound book. It's a very Christian book in that sense. And after reading it, you know, and I mean, not in one sitting, you know, it's a huge book, but after reading passages of it, I would feel happy. I would feel real optimism and real sense of, you know, that the world was a good place and that humans, that there's a lot of people that are doing, that are really good people in it. Then I would read Bill McKibben or other apocalyptic environmentalists, and I would literally feel depressed afterwards. And I was aware enough of my feelings that I thought, you know, something's not right here. At a psychological level, I thought there's something wrong here, that it's so depressing. And I didn't know enough. I mean, I just didn't know anything yet. I didn't know about energy. I didn't know about technology. I didn't really. It was 15 years ago. So, but fast forward to today, I do know all that stuff. And I felt like it all really came together. I've been kind of dealing with big parts of this paradigm. I mean, you went through that list. To get to that list took 15 years. To get to those, each of those bullet points is very, very serious.
That's right.
Very
That's why I read it.
Very carefully constructed. So for me, maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I just kind of go, when there's a lie, when there's a truth that is so obvious and so clearly understood among scientists and scholars, that is being denied publicly and denied to journalists and denied by journalists and denied by public, eventually the truth will win out. That is my belief. And I just think Apocalypse Never will make it happen sooner rather than later.
To hear Dennis's complete conversation with Michael Schellenberger, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
there are some very, very militant type forces in Black Lives Matter. And what I was issuing was a warning. How can you ever, ever have checks and balances?
Will Terry Crews hold on? The final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's The Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issues of the day. This week, violence grips our big cities.
This is happening in every city in America that's run by a Democrat.
Some in Washington, D.C. seek to give the district statehood.
It's a very popular position with the Democratic base right now.
Cancel culture infects big business.
The people who are driving the agenda are not large groups of people.
And they've come for the most popular play in America.
You can't live in a time where people are wanting to pull down George Washington statues and expect that Hamilton can go on as a love letter that it is to America.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I'm Bob France, coming to you from Cleveland in This Week for Hugh. Terry Crews has done it all. Acting, comedy, activism, professional football, and now contrarian. Terry has shocked folks by challenging the new orthodoxy in our fast-changing age. In Terry, we saw an accomplished Black American critiquing Black Lives Matter. Mike Gallagher showcased Terry's recent exchange with CNN's Don Lemon. From The Mike Gallagher Show.
Here's what Terry Crews said in this era of protest and in the aftermath of the horrific George Floyd death. He tweeted, "We must ensure Black Lives Matter doesn't morph into Black Lives Better. Are all white people bad? No. Are all black people good? No." Does that sound like something that is controversial? Certainly Don Lemon of CNN thought so. I wanted to play some of this interview with you between Don Lemon with Terry Crews on CNN.
This actor and activist Terry Crews facing backlash for tweeting, "We must ensure Black Lives Matter doesn't morph into Black Lives Better." Here's how he explained it. Are all white people bad? No. Are all black people good? No. Knowing this reality, I stand on my decision to unite with good people, no matter the race, creed, or ideology. Given the number of threats against this decision, I also decide to die on this hill. Terry Crews joins me now. Terry, man, hey. You stepped in it. You say you're willing to die on this hill. You've taken a lot of heat for this. Explain what you were thinking and why it's so important that you die on this hill.
Well, again, and I wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, there are some very, very militant type forces in Black Lives Matter. And what I was issuing was a warning. You know, it's one of those things where I've been a part of different groups. I've been a part of different things. And you see how extremes can really can go far and can go wild. And then when you issue a warning, and when a warning is seen as detrimental to the movement, how can you ever have checks and balances? You know, in the 60s and 70s, airplanes went down all the time. And the reason they found out why they did was because the pilots could never be questioned. And when you have the leaders of the Black Lives Movement who are now talking about, if we don't get our demands, we're going to burn it down. Other black people who are talking about working with other whites and other races, they're being viewed as sellouts or called Uncle Toms. You start to understand that you are now, you know, being controlled. You're not being treated as loved. You're actually being controlled.
So let me jump in here. You think Black Lives Matter is, you think it's an extreme movement?
No, this is the thing. It's a great mantra. It's a true mantra. Black lives do matter. But when you're talking about an organization, you're talking about the leaders. You're talking about the people who are responsible
for putting these things together.
I really admire the guts that it must take for an actor like Terry Crews to go on with Don Lemon and say the things you just heard.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Mike Cook, and Josh Booth. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Bob France. Great to be with you this week. Thank you for joining us.